Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to New Books in Journalism, the podcast where we talk about the latest works in journalism, media, and communication with the people who wrote them. I'm Dave Schwartz from the University of Iowa School of Journalism and Mass Communication. In this episode, we hear from Henry Jenkins and Sam Ford, two of the authors of Spreadable Media, Creating Value and Meaning in a Network Culture. It's about messages, control, and the spread of ideas in the new world order of production and consumption.
Sam, Henry, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having us.
So the book is Spreadable Media, Creating Value and Meaning in a Network Culture. And before we get into the book, and it's interesting, I've read it. How did this project come about, and how did you two find each other, as well as Josh Green?
Convergence Culture, my previous book, had come out, and I was discovering that the ideas in the book were being taken up by a number of people working across the creative industries, journalists, advertising people, producers of television shows, networks. There seemed to be a real interest, and we were interested in getting a deeper understanding of how the creative industries worked in this era of participatory culture. So we created the Convergence Culture Consortium at MIT, and this was partially a way of getting our grad students who were interested in entering the industry to create some have opportunities. It was partially about a research exchange. As we set it up, one of the first grad students to work on the consortium was Sam Ford. And shortly after we launched, we hired Joshua Green as the research director of the consortium. Sam went on to become a sort of associate research director of the consortium. And now, I guess, as the consortium has changed its name to Futures of Entertainment Consortium, you're pretty much the leader of our tribe of researchers.
Yeah, at least the coordinator. It's an interesting group to keep together. You asked how Henry and I found each other. I first encountered Henry's work as an undergraduate researching pro wrestling audiences and came across some writing Henry was in the process of doing in conjunction with his son for a collection called Steel Chair to the Head, which was the greatest name for an academic collection. It's by a scholar named Nick Salmond.
That's fantastic.
and so I knew Henry first as a pro wrestling scholar, and then discovered Textual Poachers, and his work ended up coming to the program in comparative media studies at MIT, which he was a co-director of, and was fortunate enough to launch the consortium, which we conceived of before Convergence Culture came out. And one of the discussions we were having as a group was Convergence Culture, and some of our early work was focused on a lot of fan production practices, audience production practices. Yet a lot of what was happening, a lot of the energy that was happening amongst audiences wasn't just about production. A lot of it was about the control of circulation. And a lot of the ways we'd initially framed what we were working on didn't really account for that. So as we continue doing research on how companies and content creators were developing relationships with their audiences, understanding their audiences, this focus on circulation became an increasing part of our work and started to drive what eventually became the Spreadable Media project.
And so Spreadable Media really grew out of the dialogue we were having on this community. So we kept expanding our research fellows. We kept getting new alumni who came through the program. And we'd all developed a shared vocabulary through things like the Futures of Entertainment Conference, the consortium runs every November at MIT. And so this book started as a white paper we wrote in dialogue with our client, the client companies that supported the consortium. And that was written with Chao-Cheng Li and Anna Dom. And then it evolved into a book that Sam and Josh and I worked on together. And now, as the book has come out, we now have around it something like 40 essays by various people who've been affiliated with the consortium through the years that are very integral to the book itself. And these are 2,000-word essays that live on the web. We encourage people to spread them, circulate them, engage with them in whatever ways they want. And we discuss them and engage with them critically throughout the book. And so this is a kind of hybrid of the monograph, as historically academics have written it, and some kind of anthology that's designed to provoke a conversation, to model what a conversation might look like. And so some of the grad students that contribute, alums that contribute, are academics. Some of them have been moved to industry, but they're part of the ongoing discussions we've been having as a community around these issues for 6-7 years now.
Really, the heart behind the Convergence Culture Consortium project was it was twofold. On the academic side, it was to bring together an interdisciplinary group of folks who may have been aware of one another's work but had never had as much opportunity to collaborate. So we ended up with anthropologists, sociologists, business and marketing professors, and also some academics who were hybrid in industry roles alongside professors who are in more traditional humanities roles. And then our other goal, as we engaged with partner companies in the media industries and in marketing, was to introduce them to this work of this wider range of people. So they had come to the program we had at MIT because they had heard of that program and were interested in it. But in the process, we found a lot of our scholars in our network ended up, very few of them were at MIT in particular. It was a very interconnected network across the U.S., but also increasingly globally. And so we wanted to play that dual role. So hopefully that spirit comes through in the Spreadable Media Project, where we hope, in as much as our authored text draws people's interest, that we're able to then introduce them to a range of work from other people. And with side benefit, as these pieces are available on the web, that some people will likely encounter some of those pieces first and learn about the greater book project and some of the other research being done in this space through any one of those individual pieces.
And you talked about the challenges of bringing all these voices together. Early on in the book, you talk about how this book is primarily for three different audiences. When you bring in so many different voices, and oftentimes the academic voice doesn't translate to the quote unquote the real world voice, how did you go about making sure that what you heard and what they said, both online and in the book, was something that can be applied to the different audiences?
Well, one of the things we did as we were working on this project, it was a very collaborative process. So Henry, Josh and I wrote the core book in Google Docs, which is a whole other, could be a whole focus of a podcast itself on what it's like to, rather than each write chunks of the book, actually literally write the book together. And so one of the things we tried to play a role with one another is, as we were writing sections, to think about each of those three audiences and bring the audience's perspective to that work. By the time we were halfway through this project, all of us had left MIT. And I now work in the communications consultancy space. Henry had moved to the University of Southern California in the Annenberg School, and Josh was first at UC Santa Barbara leading a media industries project, and now works for a digital strategy firm called Undercurrent. So one of our goals as authors was to bring that each of those perspectives to the text. The other thing we did very early on and through all drafts of this project is forward the text along to all our contributors and also to a pretty wide range of friends and colleagues in the media industries and the marketing world and in various fields of academia, and have them come back to us with the things that didn't make sense, the terminology that seemed arcane, the the sorts of buzzwords that seemed to slip through or that we needed to challenge. And that sort of workshopping process, we hoped, you know, our take was people would have these sorts of criticisms after the book came out. And at that point, we wouldn't be able to do much about it. As much as we could encourage that sort of dialogue while we were still working on the book, the better.
You know, as an academic, I've always been deeply committed to making my ideas as accessible to the broadest possible public. You know, I think we're living through this tumultuous period in the history of media, where media change, a period of prolonged and profound media change, it's impacting every aspect of our lives. And if media scholars sit that out and don't engage with the public as they're struggling with these issues, then we have abdicated our responsibility as professors, right? And the traditional notion of the professor is one who professes, who engages in conversations with the public. And so it's vital, I think, that we be part of these conversations. Now, it helps that I was trained as a journalist, that I worked as a journalist. So I write fairly quickly, and I write with the understanding that it's going to be read by people, which is not true of every academic writer out there, right?
Right.
And that I blog 3 days a week, you know, at henryjenkins.org, means that I'm constantly engaged with readers of my work who are not academics. And when everything's said and done, Convergence Culture sold many more copies to non-academics than people at universities. So that, to me, this is the logical next step to form this collaboration with people who are, you know, working in the industry, to involve ourselves with public policy people, to involve ourselves with all kinds of readers in the process of developing the book. So that, as Sam said, if they're going to have to weigh in when it's done, they're going to weigh in. There'll be a conversation when the book comes out. We might as well incorporate them into the writing process as much as possible.
Well, to that end, my background's in journalism as well. And, you know, there was always the talk in J school that you're writing the first draft of history. And so we very much took that notion to heart as we worked on this project. So Henry mentioned the first thing we did is we were even toying with the notion is Henry worked with a couple of the grad students to flesh out some of the core ideas in a white paper, which was very much that traditional sense of what a white paper would be, putting some of the ideas out, releasing them first within our consortium and then to the wider public fairly quickly. And we, one of the other difficulties of studying something like digital culture and this moment of media change Henry was describing is the world changing really quickly, and academic publishing is a process that doesn't necessarily respond to rapid change because you go through, in our case, two rounds of peer review. We had a wonderful editor who gave us line-by-line sorts of edits, but every one of these processes take a lot of time, not to mention the time it takes to put a book into production and do copy editing and indexing. So you're talking about a project that we started conceiving of at the end of 2007 that saw print at the beginning of 2013. So in the course, as we were working on that project over a number of years, putting the white paper out there, hosting webinars, doing sessions at the Futures of Entertainment conference, Henry's blog, certainly as he mentioned, in my case, writing some guest pieces for Fast Company and other places that I'm a contributor to, was a key way to get ideas out there and get feedback to them so that, you know, certainly a good portion of the book, as you read it in its final form, some iteration of some of those ideas had been published in a softer, less formed place somewhere before. And our goal with the book is to really, you could look at it as a collection or an anthology of our ideas and thinking over the last 5 or 6 years, finally brought together in book form.
You know, it reminds me, as you describe how you put it together, I recently heard Guy Kawasaki speak, the venture capitalist, former Apple guy.
Yep.
And he just put out a book on the self-publishing industry. And when he had a draft of it, he said he went on, I think it was Google Plus, and said, can anybody read this for me? You know, which previously was just an unheard of thing to do in the publishing industry. People might steal your ideas, or that was the fear. And instead he had, I think he said 70 or 80 people reply, and he sent them copies. And of those 70 or 80, maybe 10 or 15 actually took the time to read it and send notes back. And he worked them all back into his, you know, final manuscript. And I think we're seeing a lot more of this. You know, as I read the book, the one, a lot of ideas got me excited, but one that got me particularly interested was your I don't want to use the term war, but I'm going to. Your war on the word viral. And I just wanted to jump up and down and high five anybody. But what is it about the word viral that doesn't work in our current culture?
Well, the word viral makes us sick. I mean, at a very basic level, viral media is a metaphor of contagion, right? At its root, we're saying that someone in the industry designs a killer virus. It infects a human host. The host unknowingly takes it back to their village or their family and infects everyone they know. And it travels through without any human agency involved with it other than the agency of the designer. It's a way of maintaining the illusion of control over the flow of media at a time where traditional producers have largely lost control over it. So at its root, it's tied to notions of irrationality, of the unknowable, of, you know, loss of control. That sense allows us to do two things, right? One, and people in the industry can either shrug and say, I have no idea what happened. It just went viral. Or there's someone who rubs their hands together and says, for a lot of money, we can teach you how to make your content go viral. And it becomes arcane knowledge. And we don't believe either of those is the best way to think about it. Everything in cultural studies tells us that people pass along media for a reason, that they make a whole set of choices about who to pass it to, which content out of the flow in their inbox in any given day is worth passing along to who, through which channels, with which messages attached. And that means it's open to social and cultural understanding that I think starts when we acknowledge that people are choosing to spread your content, not spreading it accidentally.
There are two problems at hand with the way viral is used. The first is one of imprecision. So the first time viral was, as we discussed in the book, the first time viral was applied to a marketing context was in the case of Hotmail and the little messages that would go along at the bottom of an email along the lines of need a free email account, sign up at hotmail.com. And they used that as an example of viral marketing, and I actually think it was a pretty apt metaphor in that instance, because I would send along an email and unbeknownst to me, or even if I eventually came to know it, kind of irrelevant to me, this carrier marketing message goes along, and it would somewhat be like interacting with somebody and not knowingly passing along a virus to them, which I caught the flu this flu season, and somebody probably did that very thing to me, unbeknownst to them, in the course of a conversation. But the problem is that metaphor then got stretched past the point of recognition. So we started describing things that don't work at all like that as being the same sort of unknowing passage. And I would argue there are certain things in our culture now that is quite like viral marketing. So if you read a story and it shows up in your Facebook feed that you read that story or that you like something that you didn't intend to necessarily pass along, we could say that is an example of viral marketing or pass along. An action you take unbeknownst to you has a carrier marketing message that is automated that you didn't take any conscious part in. And I think those sorts of things do happen, and we're seeing platforms like Facebook engage in some of those activities more and more often and try to build them into their system. The problem is if we describe everything as viral, quote unquote, we have a hard time calling out those practices from the more conscious choices of pass along that people make. And that was one of our key distinctions. The other part of it is, to Henry's point, is this idea of agency. So much of what we're describing as viral are cases where describing them as viral strip people of any active choice they have in choosing to circulate content. And for us, that leads to the marketing industry's thinking about their audience in a very narrow way. And you know, with my marketing and communications hat on, I would say leads to a lot of failed campaigns and attempts, because companies that think they can make their audiences pass something along have a fundamental misunderstanding of this era of spreadability and the role the audience plays in it.
So let's give an example of spreadable content that probably would be familiar with the journalistic audience, the binders of women phrase that cropped up during the presidential debate last fall. This was a phrase that Romney uses in the middle of a nationally televised debate, yet CNN didn't pick up on it in its commentary immediately after the debate. If you turn to Twitter, thousands of women all over the country were tweeting immediately in reaction to this. The phrase started to grow momentum as it was still on the air. Someone set up quickly a Tumblr site and encouraged people to send in mashed up imagery. Within 2 days' time, there were several thousand of these mashed up imagery focusing on the phrase binders of women, matching it with various things, no two of which were alike. Right. It wasn't that this was a virus that was replicating itself with similar symptoms. It was people consciously made a choice. This was a phrase worth calling out and use their creative energies to create something. All of those things are traveling through different trajectories, through different communities that these people are already embedded in. And it forces the mainstream news media to pay attention to it. And the payoff was considerable. For Canada already being accused of being at war with women, we discovered first that he didn't create the binders of women, that they were given him by a feminist organization. Secondly, we find out that the cabinet positions he appointed women to were not the high-powered ones. They were secondary. Third, we find out that most when those women left, he replaced them with men. And finally, the question, why did he need binders to begin with? Well, because there were no women on the executive board at Bain Capital where his corporate experience had been. So this was each, as the thing spread, the news media and journalists did their job, began to focus on the story in a renewed way. So if we call that viral, we strip away all the political agency that's involved with it. The reality, this was a story that emerged grassroots as the public heard the phrase differently than professional journalists did. And it forced journalists to do their jobs better because this thing was being put on the national agenda through acts of circulation.
Well, and the other thing about viral is it only measures success in terms of metrics, numbers. So the idea, the success for viral means you created a pandemic, and that's the only means of success. So I think to your point, Henry, if we were to call that a viral success, then the discussion would be about how many people used the phrase, how many times the clip was viewed. It turns it into a quantitative sort of discussion that strips out, from a cultural studies perspective, much more interesting questions of why and how and the motivation of the audience for passing this along and what sorts of discussions it facilitated. I also think another danger is it causes us, when we're talking about viral, to disregard a lot of campaigns that didn't reach pandemic proportions that might have been aimed at a particular audience. So as we talk about spreadable content, we can talk about a lot of instances where stuff became very highly spread and discussed within a small community or within a certain limited context that I think can yield very interesting results, but often wouldn't be described as a quote-unquote viral success.
Sure. And Henry, you used the binders of women example, how what the media was hearing and what was going out there was different from what the people listening heard. And these are ideas that go back year. I mean, it's Stuart Hall's encoding decoding stuff. And in terms of this myth of top down control, I mean, that can go back as far as God. I mean, like Herder Herzog. I mean, so far, far back. Now there's these wonderful ideas in spreadable media. But what is it that you think it is about communication professionals that they've been so slow to, if not adopt, but to even understand this whole idea of who is in control and how people are going to be sharing ideas and sharing media versus what it is that they think that they're producing?
Well, I think we could take it back even earlier than your outline suggests. I've been reading this new book by Ellen Garvey, which talks about scrapbookers in the 19th century. And, as newspapers are circulating, people are cutting things out of newspapers and they're putting them in scrapbooks. And she describes their very conscious choices by African Americans, by early feminist groups to construct counter histories to the dominant representation of the news by choosing what to cut out, what to juxtapose on the page, creating archives that they were there. In some cases, they called out segregationists who made statements in the news that then suddenly disappeared from the public record when they were running for Canada in office later. And they were able to demonstrate this did appear in print at some moment in time. And it was a way of constructing a counter view. So journalists have lived in a world where we remix their content, where we cut out their content, and where we recirculate their content as long as we've had newspapers, right? But we've been, I think the new media environment has fundamentally changed the scope and scale at which this can take place, that it becomes that much easier to excerpt, pass along, becomes that much easier to reach large numbers of people. And we're seeing just unprecedented scopes of circulation emerging around certain things. Kony 2012, Gangnam Style, the Susan Boyle video we began the book with, all of which reach a scale that we never would have anticipated grassroots circulation could have reached before, and force things onto national agendas, international agendas that weren't there before. So I think as media professionals, you have to understand that's the world you're operating with. All signs are the current generation of young people are not sitting down and reading a newspaper on the train, and they're not watching the evening news on television. They are getting snippets of information all day long circulated to them by trusted friends and communities, and that's how we get our news now. And if you don't understand that, then you're probably doing journalism in a way that's antiquated and is not going to last much longer.
Well, and you asked, why are media and communications professionals so bad at this, for lack of a more...
I should have said some.
Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely.
Of course. And I think, the question is, there's a systemic lack of understanding of these processes. And I think it's tied up in the fact that if you look in the 19th century with the rise of the mass printing press, and in the 20th century with the rise of the broadcast paradigm, it was very hard to in any way really know your audience beyond the very base sort of quantitative ways you could have of understanding the audience. What was the circulation? What is the number of viewers that can be best estimated in a broadcast setting? So as you enter this space and age where the audience practices of passing things along and recommending things and discussing things have a textual trail, that especially as these discussions take place online, we as an industry, though, have been trained to think about storytelling and content creation from that broadcast sort of mindset. So you could look at several of the metaphors we tackle in the book as we move from the broadcast paradigm to the stickiness paradigm we talk about in the book of putting content in a place and then trying to drive an audience to it online, to the idea of viral, which would say, yes, stuff does spread, but it is the power of the content that causes it to spread, not the audience. Even to this idea of influencers, which in the marketing world would say, okay, maybe we do have to come to understand the community of an audience we're trying to reach. But in reality, there are only a few members of that community who are the tastemakers, and we really just have to understand or develop a relationship with them. All of these are shortcuts to actually really understanding and pay attention to the audience. So I would say you look back to how journalists are trained. And how people in going into PR or advertising and marketing are trained. And most of it focuses on what we want to tell the world and what it means to create the content. And not much of it is focused on developing relationships or understandings of the end audience beyond anything other than the numbers.
So Alan, I think even if journalists don't want to think about their own content in this way, they have to understand that they're living in a world where content flows are going to be affecting other people this way. So let's think for a moment of Downton Abbey, which, was aired in Britain 6 months ago, that obviously lots of information spreads through, online discussions and so forth, that the content's available on BitTorrent. PBS is plugging along, trying to string out the episodes over a series of weeks and maintain suspense and anxiety about how the outcome of the season is going to go. Even the DVDs drop 3 weeks before the end of the broadcast of the series in this case. And the journalists covering it are having to decide what constitutes spoilers and what are their way when two-thirds of their audience already knows the outcome of the storyline, but they don't want to necessarily be attacked by those who don't. And so the journalist is trying to figure out how to position themselves in relation to all of these other flows of information that are affecting consumers. They don't want to be behind the times. They don't want to be complicit in a set of practices that are trying to create secrets and create artificial scarcity. But they also don't want an angry public who feels like they were waiting to watch it on television and they picked up the newspaper and they looked on an online site and they're in the headline was information about what was going to happen in the final episode of Downton Abbey. So we live in a world where information is porous. It travels across national borders. It travels across communities. Journalists have to figure out how to position themselves in relation to that porous communication environment.
And operate within it. You know, one of the real challenges, if you think about an era of journalism, if you were a writer for the Wall Street Journal, it didn't matter so much to the reader in a way, or you didn't presume it mattered who you were, because the title of the paper sort of brought along with it a certain level of trust. And yet, as content spreads online, often people are engaging with an individual story, not reading, you know, the paper front to back. So a lot of new questions sort of arise, and the role the journalist has in actually interacting with and having relationships with their reader really changes. It's something we're seeing and dealing with a lot in terms of how journalists develop relationships with their sources, in terms of how they gather information. So you see a lot of journalists either directly or indirectly charged with developing a public presence for themselves and very entrepreneurially building themselves as a brand. And this is something you didn't learn. You know, when I went through J school, it's something we didn't even talk about, wasn't even a concept of what's my brand as an individual journalist. You developed clips, and then you tried to get those clips picked up, or reel tape if you're in broadcast, to get it picked up and get jobs, and you were defined by where you worked. And now you have instead journalists who are doing a lot of their news gathering through their readers, through the relationships they have, through participation in social media, for instance, and being able to listen to social media. So source gathering and information gathering online. And then in return, who are formally or informally charged with promoting their content, their stories, once they post, through their online presence, so that people are in many ways acting as entrepreneurs, even if they have a full-time staff job as a journalist at a particular publication. We're even seeing incentives often set up that, you know, you may get, for instance, a base level of pay and then get certain perks or bonuses for having the most forwarded or shared story in the newsroom in a given week. And to see those sorts of processes take place really changes what it means to be a journalist. I'm not saying all of these things are things that are purely should be celebrated. There are a lot of questions that raises as well. I think I would speak for Henry to say there are a lot of things we're quite optimistic about and think have great potential for a more level playing field and a more interesting media landscape. But there are also a lot of aspects of this that raises interesting ethical questions.
And Sam, you brought up the audience, the readers, and I think that's a good segue into a question I had, which was there's a really, well, cool kind of turn of phrase in here of audiences as commodity and labor. And especially when I saw labor, you know, my alarm and bells just started going off. What do you mean by that phrase of audiences as commodity and labor?
Well, neither of those are our phrases, but they're part of a critical studies tradition, which is, they actually go back to Dallas Smythe, who wrote about both of those functions around Nielsen ratings, I guess in the late 60s, early 70s. So the commodity is that our attention is what's sold to advertisers by broadcast networks, by newspapers, and so forth. That the goal of most media has historically been to attract audiences who then could be sold to advertisers. So we become commodities at the moment where our eyeballs and our attention get sold. We become labor insofar as we are actively performing tasks in order to increase the value of content. And for Dallas Smythe, watching television was a kind of labor, that it was our work of watching television that created labor. Now in the world of Web 2.0, labor is every YouTube video I contribute, every Facebook post I make, every tweet I make is making money for someone in the system. And we are not necessarily compensated for that labor by the companies that are profiting from it. So there's a strong tradition of critique around Web 2.0 that says this is exploitation. This is unpaid labor. Now we think that there's a legitimate point being made there, that there's something, an important discussion to be had. This is part of what's wrong with Web 2.0. But I think we want to go a step or two beyond that, because talking about this as unpaid labor then implies that all we got to do is compensate people for it. and then it becomes okay. And for lots of the communities we're looking at, they don't want to be part of, they don't want to be commodified. They don't want to become part of a system that the content they create as gifts to exchange with each other gets turned into commodities that are sold to begin with. That many users of YouTube object to having advertisements put on front of their videos that they created to share within their own community. Even if they got a percentage of the revenue for it, that would not be sufficient.
Go ahead.
The analogy I make that's somewhat colorful is that if you went on a hot date with someone and you made passionate love all night and you woke up the next morning and they left a $100 bill on your dresser, you would not feel that that had improved your relationship with each other, right? That you would feel like what had been given as a gift and a reciprocal relationship had been transformed into some kind of prostitution. And at that point, you would be angry, not complimented by the tip given for your services. So I think it's too simple to describe this as unpaid labor and think that the problem is we're working for someone else and you're not getting paid for it. We really have to go deeper to think about what are the social relationships that are being expressed when people choose to share content with each other using these Web 2.0 portals.
And playing around with language, one of the contentions we have in the book is even this idea that the people who create content produce all value, and the role of the audience is only to delete value. That much like, you know, even the idea of consumption or the consumer, that something is made, and then the only role the audience can have is to do away with, you know, like eating food. But of course, most we're talking about in a media context, the labor often doesn't delete or devalue, but gives more social capital to that. So we draw, for instance, Grant McCracken has a piece in the online version of the book that proposes, you know, what if we use the term multiplier instead of consumer for a lot of these practices, because the labor the audience puts into even the act of watching or reading or listening to something, all the way to the more active roles of sharing stuff, passing it along, creating content in response to it, certainly doesn't consume that product, quote unquote, in any way at all, but actually creates much more potential social and cultural and even economic value for a lot of those media products. So that's one of the main focuses or strands throughout our book, is how do media professionals understand that and start to develop strategies and processes that respect that audience labor in a way that is that coheres with how, to Henry's point, how the audience would want that labor respected. That it's not a simple, there's no simple solution to this question. In fact, you know, people looking for a handbook are probably going to be quite frustrated with spreadable media, in as much as it gains an industry audience, because it raises a whole lot more questions than it answers, I think.
So one of the examples we use in one of the online essays that tied to the book is around the television show Firefly, which built a very, very solid loyal fan base, although not enough to stay on television given Nielsen ratings.
Right.
And reached out to those fans when he wanted to make the movie and use them to demonstrate there was a market. The studio cut back on advertising for the movie, and the fans actively publicized the film, reached out to their networks, tried to get people to come in for the opening weekend, in the process of which they were selling T-shirts and bumper stickers and so forth to promote the film. A week later, the studio sends out cease and desist letters and threatens to sue them because they violated the intellectual property rights of the film producers. And rather than backing down, the Firefly fans responded by calibrating the number of hours they put into promoting the film and sent a bill to the studio for billable hours, the services they rendered in helping to publicize the film. And I think that's the spirit in which I would think about this, that fans are labor that increases value, but they're not unskilled labor. They're not alienated labor. They are labor that's actively wants to collaborate in many cases with the systems of production and are looking for the right way to do it, but certainly don't deserve to be sued by a studio that benefits enormously from their creative output.
And in the introduction of the book, we use the example as well of the Mad Men fans who actively use Twitter to perform the characters from the show and similarly had their account shut down, et cetera. The interesting thing that happened there is a lot of those fans, because that show was about the advertising industry, a lot of those fans were also media industry's professionals. They worked in the marketing world. And put together quite robust responses to the agents, to AMC, the creators of the show, and the agency that was helping promote the show, trying to argue from an industry perspective as to why it was in their own economic best interest to allow these activities to happen. So we're very interested in these moments where you can see the media industry is almost acting against their own best interest because there's been a shift in logic and they're operating by a paradigm that perhaps is becoming outmoded quite quickly.
So when you have these faux Mad Men accounts and you have this Firefly and Serenity example, you know, when you have these different parties and the expectations and the values and the motives of these different parties are in conflict, taking it back to the idea of spreadable media, what has to happen in order for participation to become meaningful participation in which all of a sudden then all parties are then working toward, I don't want to say common goal because that's not what it is, but they are all working toward the dissemination of this media.
A lot of it, I think, has to do with developing and fostering relationships. And one of the underlying themes of a lot of the book is empathy. How audiences can come to understand the motivations of the creators of the content they're passing along, and very much so the reciprocal to that. So we talk in the book about the difference between hearing and listening in one section, and how companies have been traditionally very good at hearing their audience, recording that they have said something. So you have companies who say often, yeah, we listen to our audience, we track how many mentions we get in social media and whether they were positive, negative, or neutral, and how much of the share of voice is the term that's often used in communications we own versus our competitors or versus other things in the culture. And I think those are the sorts of things that have to go by the wayside, because as long as you understand your audience, if you're a media professional, as long as you understand your audience as an abstraction or as an aggregated number rather than the actual human beings who are involved, it's going to be very difficult to foster this sort of deep understanding required to activate these relationships. And I think we have to do away with what I think a lot of in professional training, we sort of get trained against the very things we know how to do in our personal lives, which a lot of things you see companies do and media producers do. We would never walk into a party and only talk about ourselves, or only listen to if someone mentions our name and then go join the conversation then. And so many of these other things, we certainly wouldn't survey and write down attributes of the people in the room and then create an aggregate model of understanding of the people we're interacting with. All these sorts of things sound quite foreign, but the broadcast sort of mentality has driven people in marketing and media industries to take this sort of approach. And I think we're seeing a need to break that down, because if you start to understand and think about and to be able to empathize and put yourself in the shoes of your audience, your questions start to change. It's not how do I get them to pass my stuff along. It's what would be the kinds of things that they would see cultural and social value in. What would facilitate the sorts of activities they're already doing, and how do I create material that they might want to pass along? Those are, from a creative standpoint, those are very different sorts of questions you start to ask even from the beginning of the design process of creating content.
Yeah, so I think the language of brand community, which took roots maybe over the last decade and was in some ways the beginning of thinking of the consumer in a social, culturally connected way and taking a more ethnographic view on what consumption means. But it is incredibly self-centered to imagine the community only exists at the will of the brand, that we are the brands or media producers create communities around their content. Far more productive is to say that there are communities of long standing with their own traditions, their norms, their hierarchies, their values, their practices, that are having ongoing conversations around cars, technology, news, science fiction, what have you, that companies can create resources to engage with, that they should understand what those communities are and identify those communities that are most likely to have an active interest in their content, and then engage them as communities, as social entities, rather than an egocentric way of imagining that we're all your friends on Facebook. Because at the end of the day, for most products, we're just not that into you, right? We just don't care that much about the brands we're invested in. And we expect, if you want to enter our conversations, you have to enter on our terms and give us something of value. And same thing is journalists thinking that they are offering us all the news that's fit to print and ignoring all of the active interests that the various communities have that are underserved by journalists, but are the fans of news are actively collecting bits of information from many different sources and crystallizing them for their communities who want to have conversations around specific topics that news journalists have traditionally done a very bad job of covering, whether it's minority populations within a city, whether it's the disabled population or senior citizens or youth. We go down the list of things the news does a bad job of covering. We depend on each other to find those snippets of information out there and assemble them. And it's no longer about, oh, we're the community of readers of the New York Times.
Well, and similar to that, another thing journalists have traditionally been very bad at is thinking of the publishing of their piece of content as the end of the process. So typically you would do research to ultimately run a story in the paper, and that's the end of it for you. And I think here to Dan Gilmore's work about how so much of the journalism process for him eventually became seeing the publishing of an initial story as the very beginning of the process. So once you put your initial research out there and share it, then seeing what readers come back with and respond and the sort of corrections they make and the angles you didn't think about that they then introduce could lead to a wealth of potential follow-up stories. If we think of content as the ongoing fodder for a back and forth conversation rather than the thing we're trying to build an audience for. And I think that starts to shift the conversation so that one of the worst things I see happen in the journalism industry is every time something comes out, gets released, happens, that gets an initial story, and you never see the follow-up story of what happens with it after that point.
Right, exactly.
And audiences, of course, can bring a lot of those perspectives to light, but you have to have a relationship with your audience and you have to be listening. And that was a lot of Dan's work in We the Media and around the book project was to say, I love to get corrected and I love to have audiences come back and introduce new ideas, concepts, et cetera, because that could give me a year's worth of additional material to continue researching a certain subject. And I think that's a very different way of understanding as a journalist, the relationship you have to the community you serve.
Okay. Last question. Aside from hoping that the book is a commercial success and you sell millions of copies and make lots of money and right off into the sunset happily, what is your hope for the message and the content and the ideas in this book? What are you hoping that people who read this come away with and then move forward with?
Our hope is certainly not to see viral Web 2.0 influencers and so many of the other terms we focus on in the book just get replaced by a different set of terms. For us, it's very much more the thought process the book looks to encourage than it is some end goal. A good portion of our book is really focused on thinking through the sorts of metaphors and buzzwords we so often use. And I would say both in academia and in the industry, we can be quite guilty of it as picking concepts and then starting to use them far beyond their original helpful context. And that's been certainly the goal that we focused on. One of the things we say is we didn't intend to write the book on a lot of these processes, but a book on this process that would generate a longstanding conversation. So our hope would be, especially as this book gets spread among media professionals, hopefully, to introduce them to a set of questions to ask that sparks a much longer ongoing conversation. That's certainly part of the impetus behind having so many different voices involved in the overall book project. because these are people quite invested in these sets of questions, and we'll probably as a community be working on further and deeper understanding of a lot of these issues for many, many years to come. So hopefully getting more and more people engaged in thinking about these issues critically leads to a more equitable media environment. That would be my hope and goal.
You know, one of the terms we use in the book is the term moral economy. And it's from the historian E.P. Thompson, who was writing about the sort of peasant uprisings that took place during the transition from feudalism to capitalism. And he sort of, underlying argument is that underlying an economic system, there's a moral system, a sense of shared understandings of how the people relate to each other, what is ethical, principled exchange between people. Before we can exchange anything with each other, we have to have some basis of trust. And it may not be an equal basis. It wasn't certainly in feudalism, but it has to be stable and predictable. And we've just gone through this period of profound disruption where the terms of our relationships to media producers and media consumers have broken down. And what we have to now do is negotiate a new moral economy. What I, in convergence culture, with suggesting that we all know the culture will become more participatory, more people will be creating and circulating media, but the terms of our participation are still up for grabs. And what I hope our work does is makes those debates over the terms of participation that much more vivid, concrete, gives us a shared vocabulary to have those conversations with, and then inspires people to talk to each other about what a better media ecology would look like. How do we protect the rights of people who create content, and how do we protect the rights of the public to meaningfully engage with that content in their conversation? How do we ensure a responsibility of content producers to the communities they're serving? And how do we increase the responsibilities we face as individuals or communities to be over the materials we choose to circulate? Is it accurate? Is it fair? And so forth. And these are core questions of the moral economy that are going to be played out over the next few decades. And I'd love for our book to play a role of giving people some language to talk about those issues with.
The book is Spreadable Media, Creating Value and Meaning in a Network Culture. And Henry Jenkins, Sam Ford, and Joshua Green are the authors. Henry and Sam, thank you for taking some time to talk about it. Good luck with the book and with the ideas.
Take care.
You've been listening to New Books in Journalism, part of the New Books Network. You can find Spreadable Media, written by Henry Jenkins, Sam Ford, and Joshua Green, at Amazon and other retailers. Thanks for listening.